Welcome to Vicom Value and Weekly Podcast. I am Vicom CEO James Serene. I'm joined by Caleb Ben-Dor and Dr. Toby Green in Israel. We are going to be talking about a new briefing that has been published today by Vicom, which is called Hezbollah's Precision Missile Project. This tells the story of Hezbollah's attempts to turn its dumb or non-precision missiles into precision-guided missiles, which can cause devastating destruction and pose a massive threat to Israel's national critical infrastructure and also to population centers. Caleb and Toby have been working on this paper for weeks now, and it's a really brilliant examination of all the details of this project, all the way from, you know, the larger geopolitical issues down to how you actually turn a missile that doesn't have a guidance system into a missile that has a very accurate guidance system. Thank you for joining us, Toby and Caleb. It's good to have you with us.
Hi there, good to be with you.
Thanks, James.
I should just also warn our listeners that certainly myself and Caleb are still struggling with a late winter cold. So if there is a little bit of coughing and throat clearing, then we apologize. But that just adds to the atmosphere. I wanted to ask you both, really, what was the thing that really surprised you about this? I mean, we've heard a lot from Israeli military leaders, from the Israeli prime minister and others, that there is a project for Hezbollah to be doing this. It's almost like a sort of domestic arms industry, and obviously getting a lot of support from Iran. But when you kind of got into all the detail and you spoke to a lot of sort of missile and ballistic experts, I mean, what was the thing that really struck you that you didn't know before? I'm always interested to ask that question.
I think for me, I mean, I had a fascinating conversation with Uzi Rubin, who is basically considered the father of Israel's missile defense. And as we're sitting there, he told me a story that he said, we're talking about the threat that these missiles pose. And he said, you know, sometimes I go to do talks, and as I'm speaking to them, they tell me to stop. Why do they tell you to stop? It's too frightening for them. And I think there is, for me, what was interesting is we, both in Israel and outside, but the narrative is generally that the biggest threat to Israel, or the potential threat, is posed by an Iranian nuclear weapon. But regardless of what we think of the JCPOA, and actually what's interesting about the nuclear deal that the P5+1 countries did with Iran is the money that was released to Iran then got put towards Precision Project. But whatever we think about that, that is not an imminent threat to Israel. And even if there were to be some sort of weapon, there's not going to be more than one. Whereas here, it's a very significant, imminent threat to population centres in Israel. And I'm not sure that the regular Israeli on the street is really aware of the potential threat that the country's facing. So it's just as a kind of introductory remark, that for me was very striking.
For me too. I mean, when I started to work with some of this fantastic source material that Caleb had gathered in researching this paper, I too was, even though, you know, myself, Caleb, we live in Israel and we follow these issues, was surprised at the scale of the threat, bluntly, and the extent to which this really poses an imminent threat. And I must say, and how it's risen also in the Israeli national security agenda and public diplomacy agenda to become a threat that is almost on a par with the nuclear threat. And I must say, it made me re-evaluate some of my judgments about Netanyahu's policy towards Iran. I was perhaps a little skeptical or unsure about his full frontal attack on the JCPOA once it had been signed, and his attempts to persuade the Trump administration to pull out of it, which sort of split the Western alliance. But I must say, my close examination through this paper of the scale and the imminent nature of the threat with respect to precision missiles has made me perhaps have a greater appreciation for why Netanyahu is going for a full frontal pressure policy towards Iran, rather than sort of try to, you know, take advantage of the JCPOA to buy some time. Because although the JCPOA bought some time, arguably for all its flaws, on the nuclear program, it doesn't buy any time on this precision missile project. Iran's working on it now. They're working on it day in, day out. Israel has to work day in, day out to try and stop it. And it's really, really concerning the kinds of capabilities that it could give Hezbollah and Iran to hurt Israel very significantly.
Just to pick up from that question, I mean, let's take a step back and just walk through what exactly is happening here. So people who are following these events will know that Iran has significant forces in Syria and that Iran has been trying to ship advanced precision-guided missiles in their entirety to Hezbollah. And the understanding is that a large amount of the Israeli strikes in Syria have been both at those shipments when things have been trying to be brought into Syria to get to Hezbollah, or they've been on Iranian bases themselves. So you pick up the story after that. So Israel is having a lot of success against Iran, stopping it from getting these missiles in their entirety and to Hezbollah. What happens next? Why does this precision missile project begin?
Yeah, the smuggling is difficult, and due to Israeli intelligence, it's often intercepted. So the idea is that if Iran can build domestic factories within Lebanon to create parts or to take parts that have been smuggled, because smuggling parts is a lot easier than smuggling a weapon, they can upgrade a large number of regular missiles to precision missiles. And I think it's partially because Israel was so successful in stopping the transfer of the missiles through Syria that Iran began to see whether it could create domestic capacity within Lebanon to upgrade these parts.
So the issue is that they're doing this on missiles that are already in Lebanon. These are the standard missiles that are not precision-guided missiles. They're already in Lebanon. And so it's a question of how do you then upgrade them into something significantly more dangerous?
Exactly. When we began to do the research, one of the things we discovered is there are two types of missiles that are very... they're similar in weight, they're similar in length. One is the Zelzal 2 and one is the Fatah 110. The Fatah 110 is precision, and the Zelzal 2, although very dangerous, is not. And through speaking to different experts, we understood that all you need to do is you take one section out of the Zelzal 2 and you replace it with a new section which has got GPS, it's got kind of a command and control center within it, and you have created a new missile which is very, very similar to the Fatah 110, and that more or less allows you to type in the coordinates that you want. So whether that is Israeli Defense Ministry or power stations or the nuclear reactor in Dimona, you put in the coordinates, and that rocket, unless it gets intercepted, will more or less land within 50 meters of the target. These are very heavy rockets, and when they land that close, they can do a serious amount of damage. That's the kind of basic technical and technological idea behind what Iran are doing.
And without this precision guidance system, then it can just sort of land pretty much anywhere. That's the issue, isn't it?
Yeah, the significance of this upgrade to the precision capability, it really brings home Israel's vulnerabilities. I think we're used to thinking of Israel, you know, having overwhelming strength over the enemies that it's had to fight recently. If you think of its recent conflicts with Hamas or with Hezbollah, it inflicts a lot of a disruption on Israel. It's very uncomfortable, but ultimately Israel has an overwhelming force. But with these precision missiles, it really exposes Israel's vulnerabilities. We're a small country. 80% of our population and industry is concentrated in a very small, narrow coastal plain. We have one major international airport, three ports, 12 power stations, a handful of large air force bases. And, you know, you don't have to damage many of these nodal points to cause significant harm to a very small country. And that's why these precision missiles are game-changing. You can find many, many, many imprecise missiles that will hit cities, some of them, as they did in 2006, and cause a lot of disruption. But the precision missiles are a strategic game-changer. They enable Hezbollah to target critical infrastructure. And that's something that Israel really cannot allow Hezbollah to be able to do.
I think that was a really interesting point in the briefing, which is that, you know, people do assume that Israel has this very, very advanced missile defense capability, and they've seen the power of Iron Dome to deal with the shorter range missiles that don't have any precision guidance systems. It's able to deal with those. It's able to work out where they're going to go and potentially shoot them out of the sky. I think even though with Iron Dome, we saw last November where a huge amount of missiles were concentrated their fire on a small area, some get through. So the idea here as well, whereas if there's a much larger number of missiles being fired, and a large number of those are precision-guided missiles, the potential for the missile defense systems to be overwhelmed is going to happen.
I mean, we know with Iron Dome in 2014, it managed to intercept 8 or 9 out of 10 rockets that were heading for populated areas, which is a phenomenal success rate, but that still means 1 or 2 out of 10 getting through. With the other layers of Israel's missile defenses, the ones intended to intercept these kinds of longer range and heavy rockets, we just don't know what percentage success rate, because they've not really been tested in those kinds of conditions. We don't know how many precision missiles they have to fire to get one through the net. So it's just, we don't know.
I would just add on that, because Israel does not have a huge number of interceptors, there needs to be a certain priority of where they go. In such a situation, the priority will have to be on the critical civilian and military infrastructure that will allow the country to fight a war. So it will have to protect the power stations, it will have to protect the air force bases, etc. It also means, unlike Iron Dome, that the civilian centres will be less protected. So the Kiryat in the centre of Tel Aviv, the defence ministry, will be protected, but the main street, Ibn Gvirol, a few roads away, will not be, simply because it will be less of a priority. So suddenly the civilian exposure becomes a lot more potent and more dangerous for people.
I think the thing that I was most struck by in the report was that at the moment we think that Hezbollah have somewhere in quite a big range between, say, 20 or 200 of these precision missiles, probably the much lower figure. But the capability to have a production line where you're upgrading missiles reasonably quickly is quite startling. And I think you estimate in the report that it takes maybe 2 to 3 hours to upgrade a missile. It's not particularly expensive, this part of the production process. It's only $5,000 to $10,000. But I thought, I kind of did some calculations on this and realized, if you had one crew doing this for a year on a 5-day week, that they'd have nearly 800 missiles within a year, which means if you had 5 crews doing it, then you're going to get to 1,000 in a matter of months, and that's a lot. And I was really surprised by that, how quick that is, and how with a relatively small number of people doing something that's not particularly expensive, you could get to 1,000 missiles really quite quickly. And I suppose that really throws into focus the strategic dilemma for Israel. Like, what does it do now? Does it wait for these to expand and watch? Does it take a preemptive action? Can it even knock out some of these factories, which you say in the report are potentially deep underground? So what are Israel's options?
Yes, I mean, you've hit on a dilemma, and there's obviously a certain element of unknown here. We don't know exactly, it's obviously it's a sophisticated process to turn a missile into a precision missile. But exactly as you say, once you've got the pieces in place, once you've trained the people, once you've got the components, and once you've got them in a protected facility, it can happen quickly. And, we understand that Hezbollah's goal is to get, in the region of 1,000 of these things. But even with significantly less, they could do serious amount of damage. You're right. It poses a major dilemma. That's why Israel is working very, very hard on prevention right now, trying to stop the components making their way to the potential factory sites in Lebanon. But not only that, also using public diplomacy efforts, exposing intelligence about these sites, a massive intelligence effort to try and uncover these sites where this upgrading process will take place, as happened, in Netanyahu used his most high-profile speech of the year, his speech to the UN General Assembly, to reveal secret intelligence. That's extremely unusual. He showed the photographs in front of the General Assembly. Look, this is where this is happening. And subsequently, those factories around the airport in Beirut were, we understand, were shut down as a result of that. So every tool Israel is currently deploying, intelligence, exposure of intelligence, and military strikes inside Syria to try and prevent this. But ultimately, the dilemma is, what happens if you know that this production process is happening already inside Lebanon? Does Israel launch a preemptive strike against a site in Lebanon as it has done in Syria? That, of course, raises a major dilemma, because you risk the possibility of retaliation from Hezbollah with its already enormous arsenal of non-precision guided missiles, and the potential of an escalation in a sense similar to what we had in 2006, but with far greater potency, because Hezbollah's arsenal is far greater. So that's a very, very sharp dilemma for Israeli decision makers.
And presumably we talk about airstrikes and preemptive strikes, but if these are well-protected underground facilities, then there's no reason to assume that airstrikes would be successful. So it might mean that you have to have other operations, possibly even special forces and other, to try and actually deal with some of this. It's more complicated than just airstrikes.
I'm not an expert on the military dimensions of that, but certainly not straightforward. And you're right, the sites could be hardened, could be difficult to hit. It's a very tough dilemma, and that's assuming that you've got the intelligence to begin with. So it's like a constant effort. This is what the IDF calls the war between the wars. It's a constant effort to try and make sure that they can't get away with this without Israel knowing. And how long can Israel sustain and succeed in that effort? One would think Iran is very determined in the long run. They're going to keep trying at this. Hezbollah are going to keep trying at this. So this is why, as I say, I think it suddenly explains more easily why Netanyahu is pursuing a strategy of trying to put maximum pressure on the Iranian regime, because it's very difficult to sustain this containment when Iran is so determined with this very, very dangerous policy.
And also, presumably, it's very labor intensive and takes a huge amount of resources to have that kind of deep level surveillance and intelligence and other operations in both Lebanon and in Syria at the same time. That's pretty tough.
Absolutely.
The other thing I just wanted to conclude with, which I think is the sort of wider implications of this, which is, if we zoom out and we kind of zoom out of just the sort of Hezbollah Israel confrontation, we can see there is a much wider significance here. What struck me is potentially the first time that a non-state actor, this is a military organization that has been banned as a terrorist organization in many countries around the world, that has developed the capability, albeit with Iran's help and huge amount of financial investment and another logistical support, but nonetheless, a non-state actor has developed the capability to turn sort of standard ballistic missiles into devastatingly destructive precision guided missiles. That is a game changer, not just for Israel and Hezbollah, but also a game changer for kind of world peace and security. You say in the report that this capability has already been shared with Houthi militias in Yemen. It's possible that this could be shared reasonably quickly with Shia militias in Syria and also in Iraq. What are the other wider implications? What does this mean? Is this a moment not just for Israel and Hezbollah, but a moment of kind of world order and disorder where something has really changed in terms of the balance between countries and their armed forces and non-state actors and terrorist organizations?
I'm not sure I'd go so far as to say it's the balance between order and disorder has now been moved. But yes, the Houthis have in Yemen have this technology. One of the things we looked at in the paper is, on the one hand, once you've got everything in place, it can be done quite quickly. But getting the stuff in place in the first place is difficult. You need to build the factories. You need the factories not to be discovered. You need to build the components, and then you need to transfer the components. And then you need scientists or experts who know what they're doing to do the upgrade. Lebanon and Hezbollah are very well placed for this, but I think just because the technology is out there doesn't necessarily mean it will be easy for other militias to have. I'd also say this, even non-precision missiles can do a huge amount of damage. But yes, there are several American bases in the region, there are British troops in the region, and if not just the technology, but the capacity to upgrade these missiles does get shared around, that could be a very, very serious threat moving forwards.
think about it in terms of the confrontation between, or a potential, we hope never will happen, but a potential confrontation between Hezbollah armed with this kind of missiles and the IDF. The IDF obviously has enormous military capabilities. Were Israel to be attacked by a missile arsenal with this kind of potency, or threatened by a missile arsenal of this kind of potency, the level of force one can imagine Israel being compelled to use to overwhelm that potential threat, I think would be of an order above what we have seen in the past. We've seen in the past, Second Lebanon War in 2006, you know, Israel used significant military force against Hezbollah in Lebanon, but it allowed that conflict to rumble on for 34 days. It did not go from zero to 60, you know, immediately. It built up, you know, it only used ground forces later, in relatively small numbers till towards the end of the war. Similarly, in the conflict against Hamas and other armed groups in the Gaza Strip in 2014, you know, Israel allowed that conflict to rumble on for 50 days before it really started using its more potent force, leveling apartment blocks and whatever, to force Hamas to cave in. Israel's not going to be able to sustain a war for 34 days or 50 days against an enemy that's using these kinds of strategic weapons. So Israel is going to move up, one would expect, to a level of response much higher and much quicker than we've seen in the past. And I think could be, you know, that's another concern for how fast a conflict would have to escalate with these weapons in the game.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've talked about the first phases of a potential future Lebanon war along those lines, and about how the destruction in the first few days is, as you say, would be on a level of magnitude that, you know, both sides wanting to, you know, Israel trying to knock out these missile facilities, Hezbollah trying to use them before they're potentially destroyed. Yeah, it's a very, very dark scenario, which brings us back to Caleb's first point about the expert who gives talks and people ask him to stop talking because it's...
But that's also important, I think, James, that's the international community dimension as well. That's why Israel, I think, is also investing a lot in communicating to, you know, its friends around the world the potency of this threat, because we hope never to happen, were this kind of conflict to actually take place, it will have to explain why it's having to use such potent force against this kind of threat. And so it is communicating now what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's that point that, I mean, just to conclude, is what you say in the paper, which is that it really is incumbent on the UK, US and other allies of Israel in the region and beyond to actually take action, to warn the Lebanese state about how dangerous this situation is. And let's not forget that, you know, the presence of Hezbollah with such significant weaponry is a gross violation of Security Council Resolution 1701. There's not supposed to be another major military force apart from the Lebanese armed forces in the country. And the fact that Hezbollah is, you know, developing and building these weapons is a very serious violation, and it really is incumbent on those countries, and particularly Security Council members, to actually take action.
And Iran also is flagrantly violating UN Security Council resolutions by delivering these kinds of weapons to Hezbollah. People talk about, Iran is in compliance with UN resolutions on the nuclear deal. Well, that's arguable, but it's certainly breaching these kinds of resolutions with the equally dangerous consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, on that note, gentlemen, we will leave it there. Thank you very much. And it was a fascinating discussion. I would advise all our listeners to have a look at the paper, which is published on Friday, the 15th, Hezbollah's Precision Missile Project. And there are some very useful pictures and infographics and maps that really do bring home just the scale of this problem. But Toby and Caleb, thank you. And thank you very much for your work on the paper.